Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm going to get right to the interview this week, and our interview is with Chef Greg Backstrom of Olmsted Restaurant in Brooklyn, New York. Most people listening to this are probably familiar with Greg and or Olmsted. It's a restaurant that opened just a little more than a year ago, but it caught fire pretty immediately. And it's one of these restaurants that comes along once in a while that seems to really sort of encapsulate and capture what's going on with young chefs and with restaurants and hospitality and restaurant food in the United States at a given moment. It is technically what you would probably describe as a neighborhood restaurant. It's only about a 50-seat restaurant. It's very affordable. But Greg brings to it a pretty serious background, even though he's a young guy. He's in his early 30s. But he's worked at Alinea in Chicago, Blue Hill Stone Barns, and Per Se, and Atera in the New York area. Some fairly important restaurants in Europe, which we get into in the interview. And a lot of the people who work for him have similar backgrounds at comparable places. And that all gets sort of funneled, all of that technique and passion and experience, into a very affordable, what would technically, again, be a neighborhood restaurant, but in reality has, for a lot of people, become a destination restaurant. They've received a ton of media attention. They've won several awards already. And it's a great opportunity for me, and I think for you guys, to hear a chef who just recently became a chef owner, when all of the experience of making the transition from a cook and a chef de cuisine to an actual chef owner is still very fresh. And that's where Greg is in his career. And it was great to be able to talk to him about it. We sat down across the street from the restaurant in Greg's new apartment. I hadn't seen it yet, and it was a good, quiet place to do the interview. So that's where we met. And we talked through his career and the opening of the restaurant and what he's learned in his first year plus in business. And I think it's really interesting. And Greg's a guy whose work I'm very fond of, and I think you're going to enjoy this interview a lot. And that's all I'm going to say about it. Let's get right to it. Here's Chef Greg Backstrom of Olmsted Restaurant, recorded about a week ago at his home in Brooklyn, New York. I hope you enjoy it. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. Greg, it's great to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me. Why don't you tell people where we are?
We are in my apartment on my new couch.
On your new couch in your new apartment. How long have you lived here now?
Just a couple of weeks.
Yeah. And can you just tell people we're in what proximity to Olmsted?
Like 40 paces.
Wow. And how is what was the thinking behind that? Was it like, well, I'm going to be here all the time anyway, I may as well just save myself the cab fare home at night because this is where I am all the time?
Yeah, you know, I've always, you know, wanted the separation from work, you know, but at this point I'm still working 7 days a week, so I just figured embrace it,
Yeah. And
I have a 1 minute commute now.
So. Yes. Any buyer's remorse, or was the right call?
No, not at all. Yeah. I mean, like, I can even go home and change into for service and, you know, come back. I can grab a cookbook off my shelf now and bring it back to the restaurant.
That's
much
great.
Quicker. Yeah, it's way better.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd love, before we kind of get into your backstory, you know, you are, well, as we sit here, we're in the same week that you were named on Jeff Gordner's list in Esquire of the best new restaurants in the country. Congratulations.
Yep. Thank you.
You've had a lot of attention like that since you opened the restaurant.
Yeah, fortunately, yeah.
What, can you just give a sense, you know, my... You know, people see someone at this moment that you're at, which is, you know, this extended moment of sort of taking off, right? Where there's this sense of upward trajectory. And I think there's this sense of, wow, that life, that must be fabulous, you know? What's the day-to-day like for you?
I mean, it's still hard. I mean, like, hopefully it is on an upward trajectory. You know, like, hopefully this is, you know, it's not just year one.
Right.
Hopefully this is the beginning of a 30-year career, 40-year career.
Yeah.
But the day-to-day is still, I'm still there every day. I still work the pass over the line every day.
Yeah.
Staffing is still difficult. We want to expand. We want to build a bigger kitchen. We want to build, you know, we want to build on the brand. We want to build new restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to find a team to be able to do that.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, it's a challenge.
Yeah.
It's small. I mean, we're a 50-seat restaurant with 31 employees, and six of us are cooks.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
like,
amazing.
That is some odd math for a small neighborhood restaurant.
Yeah.
You know?
And even with that number of cooks, I mean, and today, I don't think I'm giving away anything because it's on Instagram all the time. There's periodic turnover.
Oh, all the time. All the time.
This is a fact of life these days for anybody who does what you do.
I think now maybe it's 16 weeks before is the longest that we've gone without losing somebody.
Without having to fill a position.
Yeah.
Wow. What's the frustration level like on that?
Oh, it's immense. I mean, it's as soon as we're fully staffed, I start to commit to more charity events and to some out of town stuff to, you know, keep us promoted and keep the attention on us. And, you know, right when I'm packing my bags to go do that event, someone drops out or something happens and we lose somebody. And it's, you know, it forces Jenny or some, you know, the other staff.
Jenny's your chef de cuisine.
I don't mind that I work 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Like, it's part of it. And I like it. Like, I genuinely like it.
Yep.
But I don't want I never wanted to work 6 days for anyone else. So I'm not going to expect someone else to want to work for six, even whether you're being compensated or not.
Right.
Just, I want my 2 days off.
Yes.
So.
Well, you even advertise that when you do your,
because it's important.
Do your social media announcement of the job, you put the salary right out there.
Yeah.
And you put 2 days off every week as part of the public job description.
Too. I mean, it's important. Like you have to balance, you are working 65 hours a week.
Yeah.
You have to have some balance.
Right.
You know, even if it's not like it's a stretch to say that those 2 days you're really completely unwinding and like your head is still in the restaurant.
Right.
You're still decompressing. And by the time you decompress, you're jumping right back into it.
Yeah.
So one is just not enough and two is barely enough.
Right. As you go through this period of time where that does happen semi-regularly, what's the balance? I mean, you need to find people obviously who are technically able to do the job, right? But then you just alluded to it even a second ago. There is that piece of it is like you're trying to put together this cohesive group that can function well. How do you go about gauging something like that? Is it just by having people
really
come
gauging.
In and trail?
To be honest, sometimes it's just taking who comes.
Uh-huh.
Like it really gets to that point sometimes. Like when it's been 3 months of, you know, forcing everyone that works there to work 6 days, you just hire the next person.
Forget about the chemistry and make
the
round
the
peg fit the square hole.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and as we've, you know, as we've gotten a little older, you know, we're what, like 17, 18 months old now.
Right.
You know, we're getting more experienced applicants. The front of the house by far has gone from, like when we opened, we intentionally did not hire, you know, front of the house with a ton of experience, especially not a ton of fine dining experience. Just because we just really wanted to fight the standard, the cliche sort of service moves, just the song behind with their arm behind their back, the same way you're greeted. That's why we have the menus already on the table. We come to the table with still water and say, is still water okay? Instead of asking, do you want sparkling water? Like, we have sparkling water. If you want it, you can ask for it. Otherwise, we're going to get going.
You know what?
Here.
I've never noticed that you guys do that. And it's amazing. Never noticed that because to me, and I guess I'm talking about all of our friends because this is basically everybody, but that water thing is such a game. That people, you know, we're tap, you know,
They don't even say just ice water. It's always, would you like sparkling still or tap?
I always feel like a loser. Almost like it's coming
out of, almost like it's coming out of a garden hose, like behind the restaurant.
And I feel like a hobo or something.
Right?
You
but
know,
that to me is
tap.
The game, is you're being kind of like, you know, as the magicians would say, you're being kind of pushed in that direction. I never really, for some reason, it never lodged with, thank you for doing that, Greg. Yeah. So, that is great that you do
so
that.
So the only thing that has to be brought to the table is the like the wine list and the cocktail list.
Yeah.
And so we just didn't want, we thought it would be easier to train new moves than to chip away at bad habits, or in our case, bad habits.
Right.
Now we are very fortunate, you know, they make the front of the house makes Manhattan money in Prospect Heights.
Yep.
So we're getting talented people that, you know, a lot of industry lives in this neighborhood.
Yeah.
So the front of the house has really come a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And the kitchen team is great. It's just hard to keep it always staffed because it's challenging. It's very, and just as it's challenging in the front too, but you know, we are pushing what Olmsted should be doing, like what a restaurant that size rather should be doing, and its capabilities. It's a tiny 50-seat restaurant with a small basement.
Right.
We have speed racks zip tied to the ceiling because there's just nowhere to put a shelf.
Right.
We have, you know, these beautiful plates, you know, in a restaurant that as many people as it does should have, you know, cheap plates with warranties on it, you know?
Right.
You know, we have, every time we change the menu, we change the serviceware, you know, mostly because like that is my experience with changing the menu at Stone Barns and at Alenia. It's like the if the dish changes, everything changes.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
And so, you know, now we have a storage unit for all these things that
offsite.
An offsite storage unit because it's just okay. The monkfish is off. That plate goes in storage, and now we need
amazing.
You know, a new set of plateware or something.
Yeah. So take me back. You grew up in the Midwest.
Yeah.
You're from Chicago.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's just a coincidence. You're the third guest already in six shows who. Either is from or made spent time in their career in Chicago.
Yeah.
Definitely the youngest of the group by a little bit, not that much younger than Alex Stupak, but younger. What for you growing up in that town was your awareness of, if at all, of sort of the culinary legacy of that city, or was there any?
There wasn't any yet. I mean, it was. I mean, when I was in school, I knew of Michelin. Like when I was in culinary school, I knew of Michelin. So of Michelin, there's, you know, one, two, and three. So three was the best. So that's what I tried to strive for.
Yeah.
And I got in that was just France. So I went and did an internship in France. And when I came back, Eagle, it was the blog that foodies looked at.
Yep.
I don't even know if it's still around or not, but. On that was Chef Ackett's, you know, testing for Alenia. And to be honest, I didn't know what Trio was. Trio was already closed and Alenia was opening.
Right.
You know, I wasn't that plugged in. I'm not that old, but internet was not that, I wasn't on Facebook. I didn't do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't play video games.
Yeah.
To me, that was all just like sort of that type of culture.
Yeah.
That was more my brother's thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, back then there was, like on a Monday, you would just go to Avec, Paul Gahan's restaurant, and you would just see everybody in the industry on a Monday because it was the only restaurant that was open on Monday.
Uh-huh.
And it was like the coolest restaurant.
Yeah.
And we could afford it. So, I mean, that was, you know, 12 years ago now at this point. 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And between Chef Ackett's and Paul, like it's just a different town now.
Yeah. So, but before all that, how did you... how did you first get interested in going after this as a career? What was,
honestly, I think it was the Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
You know, like, it was, you know, the Boy Scouts probably for a few reasons though, like that military sort of, you do this, you've earned this, then you move on to the next rank. And now you have to pass that knowledge down.
Yeah.
You know, as you get older, when you're young, when you're in second grade, your parents are cooking your meals when you're camping. Like a big part of it was the camping.
Yeah.
And
but before you go any further, you you weren't just a Boy Scout, right? I mean, you were really, this was a big part of your childhood.
It was my, yeah, I mean, the, I tried to quit. My dad didn't allow me to quit things. So
you wanted to quit the, why?
Because I thought like 8 years of it was enough, you know, like, but.
You started at what age?
From second grade till after high school.
Okay, so second grade, so then you're kind of late into high school. You were like, that's enough, and your dad said...
Tiger Cubs, Boy Scouts, Tiger Cubs, Cub Scouts, yeah. Boy Scouts.
So you're earning badges and all that stuff.
All that, yeah.
Yeah.
Until eventually Eagle Scout.
Yeah.
So, but in that, like, you have to cook for yourself in your patrol. Within the Boy Scouts, there are kids your age.
Yeah.
And so eventually you have to start cooking for each other. And just the way my parents raised me and my dad specifically was just, you know, don't even do it if you're not going to do it well. So, you know, not like basically we only made beef stew. That was because it was just put everything in a pot and let it boil until it was ready. Yeah. But there was just something about that, like that type of, if you're going to do it well. And this sort of military-like component to it that I really liked. You know, it got exhausting to the point where I wanted to quit. But I really did like the camping with my brother and my father and cooking and just the culture of it. Like,
yeah.
You went up to an adult, you shook his hand, you said, sir, you know, thank you, blah, blah, blah.
And like, you responded well to all that.
Yeah, I loved it.
But you seem to me, it's funny, there's a lot of people I know who end up cooking who, and this, it's a bit of a cliche to put it this way, but you know, there's a lot of people who end up in kitchens, or at least who used to end up in kitchens, who were kind of like, you know, the hard case kids who were kind of difficult. And I think that the hierarchy of a kitchen was almost something they needed or responded to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you don't seem like that kind of guy. I mean, it seems to me like you've always kind of been.
I'm straight and narrow.
You're straight, but have you always been? You seem like someone who's kind of always been like that.
Yeah.
Is that because of your dad?
Yeah, my parents. My dad is the kind of guy, like I said, if you're going to, you know, measure twice, cut once.
Yeah.
Don't ever, you know, don't even try if you're not going to do it right.
Yeah.
And then, like, my mom's train of thought, or my mom was more the. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all.
Yep.
So like I am those two ethoses, you know, personified combined.
That's great.
Adult.
Yeah. So through that, so you were saying though, at some point you start cooking, the kids start cooking in the Scouts.
Yeah. And so whether that's just scrambled eggs, honestly, even hot chocolate and cocoa, but it gets, you know, as you get older, you just take on more. It's no different than being in a kitchen and being an intern and becoming sous chef.
Yeah.
If you are capable, it has nothing to do with age.
Yeah.
It is, if you are capable of doing the next thing, then you are allowed to do the next thing.
Right.
So if that's wielding an axe in your 12 years old in the Boy Scouts, if you are capable of doing it, then you are allowed to do it. If you are not trained to do it, if you don't have that merit badge, if you haven't been signed off on it, if chef hasn't shown you how to reduce that sauce, then you don't get to do it.
Right.
You know.
And so, what about it did you respond to? In other words, did you, people talk about kind of the transformative thing that happens when you start cooking. People talk about the pleasure of feeding other people, just loving the actual physical, tactile kind of process.
Yeah, for me, it's not like I didn't have a grandmother that I cooked with. Like, I don't have that type of background.
Right.
Not that my parents didn't cook and we ate around the table every night. But
it wasn't a focus.
No.
Yeah.
Like, we had track. We had Boy Scouts. We had, like, my dad made us have jobs when we were 15.
And then
like,
you needed to eat.
Yeah. Like, it was, like, keep going.
It was fuel.
That was staff meal.
Yeah.
Our dinner was staff meal, you know?
Right.
But, I liked, there's everything from, you know, you make something, you're sitting in front of someone while they're eating it, and you get to see them, that reaction.
Yeah.
To the craft, you know, my dad was a carpenter. He built stuff with his hands. And it's no different. When you're making a pasta or you're making a dresser, like it's...
you connect those two things.
Yeah, you're making something. You're doing it with your own abilities.
Yeah.
Like it's there. If the pasta didn't work out, if the drawer doesn't open in the dresser, like it's your fault.
Yeah.
You need to be better.
Yeah.
Do it again the next time.
Right.
You know, try harder and make the pasta.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. I just like, I love the idea that, okay, so I can cook a piece of meat, but you know, how are my bread skills? Okay, I suck at probably making bread because I don't do it. Right. I don't devote my life to that. Right. But I like that if I had free time, right now yep. I don't, that I could start working on brioche or start making Parker House rolls or,
right.
There's just not one reason why I like doing this. It's
yes.
just, it's, I don't know. It's, I find it incredibly fulfilling.
Uh-huh. And so you decide pretty early that this is going to be the course you're going to set out on?
Yeah, like by 16.
By 16.
Yeah.
And you go to Kendall College.
I do, yeah.
In Chicago.
It's in Chicago. It was in Evanston, Illinois. And then while I was doing my internship in France, they actually yeah. moved it downtown.
Got it. And how did you find your way into Alinea?
Honestly, I was doing a final to graduate from Kendall.
Yeah.
And the final was design a restaurant.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to design a tasting menu restaurant because I, you know, I knew the French Laundry and yeah. you know, and Charlie Trotter's. So I knew that this restaurant was opening.
Right.
I called, said, can I, this was the week it was opening. I called the week before it opened and said, can I come and talk to somebody? I have a project.
Was this like a front of house person you got on the phone?
I think
or
it was,
do you remember?
It was John Peters, one of the original sous chefs.
Really?
And
this person took your call at that time and spoke to you.
Yeah. And he said, why don't you come in and we'll talk. That just turned into a trail. There was a miscommunication.
Yeah.
Nothing happened school related. Like there was no talk about how, like there yeah. was no sit down with Chef Ackett's.
Yeah.
So how did you build this restaurant? You
yeah.
know, it was, you know, peel the carrots and the cut.
So you thought you were going in to do yeah. like an interview?
Yeah. I just, yeah.
And they like gave you an apron yeah, and said, let's see it. How you do, kid.
Yeah. And at the end of it.
Was it at all noticeable, remarkable to anyone that you didn't show up with like knives or anything?
I bet I came with them just in case.
Oh really?
I'm sure I did. Yeah.
Okay. That's the Boy Scout training.
Yeah.
Be prepared.
yeah. It is the motto, you know.
That's really funny.
I can recite the law, the oath, the motto,
yeah,
whatever,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But at the end of it, oddly enough, Chef Ackett's came up to me and said, so what's your story? And I said, I just like went into, I'm looking for an internship.
Yeah.
Like I had already done two. You only needed to do one.
Yeah.
And like I just spit out, I was looking to do an internship. So he said, okay, do your internship here.
Yeah.
So I just started showing up.
That's crazy.
Like it was not school related. I had a cut down to part-time school so that way I could go do mise en place, then during staff meal go back and take like I think it was ethics or something,
uh-huh.
and then come back for service. And I did that for just like an amount of time, like 5 months, for just like it was like just until the end of the year.
What was the travel time between the restaurant and the school?
It was like, oh, I could ride a bike.
Oh, you could?
Yeah.
Okay.
So not that anyone would really know, but the school is on Halsted, Alinea is on Halsted, and my apartment was also on Halsted.
Okay.
So I was able to just ride a bike up and down.
What was it like for a kid, you know, you knew like Grant's background, you knew he came from places like the French Laundry.
Yeah.
You're this kid who like sets his sight on this world, and then you find yourself, you know, almost in this like movie scene, working there as it's about to be unveiled to the world. Can you just, what was that moment in time like for you?
I mean, like,
from your eyes, like, what, how do you remember that time? That had to be amazingly intense.
I mean, I remember the first thing, like when I came back to do my internship.
Yeah.
I remember like my first interaction, like I had did the interview. Then I came in to eat dinner. But somehow I got a reservation at the last week.
Okay.
Or no, the second week it was open.
Yeah.
And that, so that was, it opened May 4th or May 5th. I ate on June 22nd.
Then this is 05, right?
Yeah, 05. Yeah. And then the following week I started my internship. And like, I remember seeing pictures of frog legs on one of the dishes and I had chicken instead. And the first thing I said to Chef was, I said, hello, you know, and I said, actually, I had just eaten here. And I just like to try to make conversation. I said, so I had chicken instead of frog legs, and he just spit out. And I asked, you know, why did he decide to change the menu? He just said, you know, it was a wild product. You can't get them all the time. But uh-huh. it was just like, in the way he said it, it was like, oh yeah, don't ask questions like that. And then like the first task he gave me was to take the stickers off the peaches. Like uh-huh. I remember every detail, every action with that man. I remember
yeah
perfectly
yeah
in my head
yeah.
And it was after being there for a week, there was me, Andrew Brochu, and one other guy.
Okay.
Andrew Brochu is now the chef of Royster.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the first three interns of the restaurant. And I was placed, we were all given to like one of the other chef de parties as the commis, as their assistant.
Yeah.
So I was given to the Garmager, chef de partie.
Yeah.
A week later, he quit though. And so Grant just came up to me and was like, either I hire somebody or you step up. So that was my in. That was my opportunity. So I ran with it.
Yeah.
And it became apparent that that's just how it works. So after I was on that station for a while, the station that was across from me, that was the next level, you know, you just slowly try to take some of their mise en place away and say, I'll do it for you. And then eventually you're just on that station. And that's how, you know.
I mean, that's a real lesson, right, for young cooks, to make yourself as useful as possible.
Yeah, like it doesn't go unnoticed.
Yeah.
Like if you are the strongest guy in the room.
Yes.
Or, you keep your head down and you work, like it's all cliche and it's obvious.
Yeah.
But it's not going unnoticed. It's not like, it's you accumulating skills.
Right.
It's not some like mysterious thing or someone's trying to take advantage of you or someone's trying to give you a lot of work to do.
Well, it's the ultimate win-win situation, right? You as a young cook, and I've heard this from a million chefs, people who've become chefs, you know, that when they were in a kitchen, they just wanted, you know, give me more. Can I come in early and learn how to do X?
Right.
So, I mean, from that point of view, you could say it's completely selfish and self-serving.
Sure.
But also, you and I were talking before we started recording, you know, every chef I know, ultimately, one of the things they want from their team is just for them to make their life easier.
Yeah.
So if you're the guy or the woman who in the kitchen who they know can do X, Y, and Z, who they know is highly motivated. I mean, yes, it sounds very cliche as I'm saying this.
When you say it out loud, it's just
I feel like I'm on some stupid panel, like just saying stupid stuff at some dumb conference, but you know what I'm saying.
But it really is that way.
But it is that way.
You know?
And not everybody is built that way.
And that's ultimately what it is. It's, you know, I was on that station for a very long time. And I've said this before that, you know, almost every station had a sous chef that they passed to.
Yeah.
And the person that I passed to was always Chef Eckerts.
Yeah.
And so there was just no getting away with anything.
I mean,
it was just, you know, not even just like the quality of it. It was just everything had to be handed to him the right way, in the right order. There wasn't like put the squab on the pass and then the plate. Like it was just everything was the right way always.
Yeah.
And my station partner was John Shields. For quite a while, and he is now, you know, the chef of two Michelin star restaurants in Chicago. But he used to do the same thing that I did, and he's probably who I learned it from. There were two people supposed to work the station, and he would just make me feel like this is one man station, and I'm helping you. Like you need to get the shit down. Like,
yeah.
But it was a two man station,
right?
But there was a point where eventually I was doing most of the prep for both of those stations,
right?
And then he was now he's the Tornade.
Right.
He doesn't have a lot to do on a station anymore, so now he just floats around and helps everybody.
Tornade, for people who don't know, is basically a floater. It's someone who's able to jump in at any station in a kitchen.
Yeah, he's like, it's clear that he will be the next sous chef.
Yes.
You know, when that position becomes available.
Yeah.
And so he made himself that position, and then I took over these two stations. You know.
So how long were you ultimately there?
Almost 4 years, like 3.5 years.
And then from there, where'd you go? Where was your next stop?
I went to Spain.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't, like, I loved everything about Alenia. There's not, like, I cannot say a bad thing about my experience there.
Yeah.
But I didn't know if our ice cream was the best ice cream. Like, I hadn't eaten around everywhere. I was fortunate enough to eat at the French Laundry with Chef Eckerts and Per Se once.
Yeah.
But, like, beyond that, I had never eaten
Your
anywhere.
World was pretty small in terms
small.
Of food.
Yeah. Yeah. So I didn't know if our ice cream was great, if our trash cans were cleaner than everyone else's.
Yes.
Like I didn't know. And, you know, and we're just being told we're great all the time. And every time we get an award, we're having an all staff meeting, we're having champagne.
Yeah.
But like I needed to put that into perspective.
Yeah.
Like, how real is this?
Yeah.
So I went to Spain. Chef helped me set up internships at El Bulli, it was still open then.
Yeah.
Arzak, and then I did a stint at Muguriz for 3 months.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah, it was good. It was great.
It's a pretty good trio.
It is. Yeah, and you know, it's not like I was able to save up a ton of money working at Alenia.
Yeah.
But if you and I did the same thing with France and the same thing with Norway. If you just find a, like, it's hard, but if you find a place to sleep, you only really, you're eating at the restaurant.
And that's your life.
So you just need to be able to buy a coffee in the morning and a beer at night.
Right.
And you can get by. So you can get by for a few months on a couple of grand.
Yeah, you don't really need a lot of spending money when you're working like that. You're basically living at the restaurant, sleeping and doing your laundry once a week.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. And from there, I moved to New York to work at Per Se.
What was the primary motivation for, was Per Se the motivating factor, or were you thinking you wanted to kind of come to New York and check
out?
No,
it was Thomas. I wanted to work for Thomas Keller.
Specifically.
Yeah, and I was fortunate to eat at the French Laundry with Andrew Brochu and Chef Ackett's.
Yeah.
And we had a 30-course, one-by-one-by-one meal.
Uh-huh.
And Chef Keller was there.
Yeah.
And then Alenia went on break. Not that long after, like a month or two for about a week.
Yeah.
So in a very short span, I got to eat at the... So I came to New York in that break.
Yeah.
And I ate at WD-50, Blue Hill, New York, and Per Se.
Wow.
So that was my eating experience. And I figured that was pretty well-rounded for not really being a part of the New York scene.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, my meal was better at... And Chef Keller was at Per Se at this meal. My meal was better at Per Se than it was at the French Laundry. Like I'm not like, I remember everything. I remember more of my meal at Per Se. And I don't know. There was just something about it.
That's really interesting.
I don't know if it was because it was my first time to New York, although it was my first time to California.
Yeah.
You know, I was just a kid from the Midwest. I hadn't been anywhere, you know.
It's so funny to me because it's so hard for me to compare those restaurants because to me the French, I mean, it's sad to be talking about it in the aftermath of the fires that were just out there, but, you know, to be in Yountville to me with their, I mean, they call it very, to me, very charmingly, like the garden, but basically their farm across the street.
Right.
And all these little inns and their bakery down the road. I mean, that's such a part of it to me.
Oh,
and,
totally.
And Per Se, you're in New York. I mean, you're from another big American city. Like,
but it was just the technical
thing. Yeah, no, I get it. It's just, like,
I ordered a gin and tonic because I saw Chef Ackett order a gin and tonic.
Yeah.
Like, I just was fucking going along with it. You know, like, how do I not embarrass myself?
Right,
you know?
Right. Like being put in prison. Like, I'll just do what the guy next to me's doing.
Like, I was just like, looking like in awe of everything. Oh my God, I'm having French fries with Chef Ackett's right now. Like,
that's so funny.
And for whatever reason, without, like, that, like, I still remember being in the front seat when he was driving and we were going to the event. Like, none of that is lost on me, but for the meal felt technically.
So you get a job. How old are you at this point?
Probably like 22 or 23. Uh-huh. Yeah, I got it.
This is when Jonathan Benno was
still there. Yeah. So my experience at Per Se was, you know, essentially the transition. It was 6 months or so with Chef Benno and then 6 months or so with Eli.
Okay.
And I was never planning on staying in New York.
Yeah.
I really thought I was going to do the Per Se thing and come back.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if I got to sous chef, great. So maybe that would make, you know, my 2-year plan a 3-year plan kind of thing. But again, Chef Ackett's, you know, stepped in and he happened to be eating at Blue Hill Stone Barns. My name came up. Dan was looking for a chef. And a couple of days later, Dan called me up and we met. And so I ended up jumping ship.
And you went to Blue Hill Stone Barns, which for people who don't know is, I don't know, maybe take you about an hour to get there from Midtown, maybe depending on traffic.
Yeah.
How long were you at Stone Barns?
Like 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah. It was great. I mean, I
can you just give people a sense of what that setting is like? And because when people hear New York, if they're not from New York, I mean, that is not a New York City restaurant. That is...
No, it's a giant farm with, you know, everything is so... It's a Rockefeller estate, so everything is beautifully built.
Yes.
You know, there are greenhouses, there's pigs, there's everything. It's a fully working farm with a restaurant in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I definitely didn't appreciate it as much while I was there.
Yeah.
I mean, I appreciated that there was a farm growing. All the obvious things of having a beautiful restaurant, you know, in a farm.
Yeah.
But I took, you know, getting ready for service so seriously as I should in my role that, you know, maybe a couple of times I would walk around the farm But otherwise, I just felt like, why am I romantically walking out in the garden when I have a pig to butcher or something?
Right.
Like there are 20 kids here trying to get ready for service. Like, don't be walking around in the greenhouse.
Right.
If something is growing, just tell me in an email and I'll work it into the menu. Like, right. That was sort of my outlook on it.
Yeah.
Which sort of sucks in hindsight.
Yeah. Where were you living when you worked there?
I was living downtown. I moved from New York to Lower Manhattan just because I saw all the trains went to Lower Manhattan. Yeah. So I just figured that was like easy to get places.
Yeah.
But so I moved to 96 in Lexington.
So you commuted every day?
I commuted every day.
Yeah. So what time would you get home at night?
Like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Uh-huh. And you'd be back up there by when?
Before, like 11 on the late side. No, 12. 12 on the late side. So like between like 10 and 12.
When you look back at, I mean, you're still a young guy, but when you look back at that, does that just seem insane? I mean, you know,
I work more now. What do you mean?
Well, yeah, but you live across the street. But no, but I just mean, I mean, you know, I think about Young Cooks the way, not that I ever lived it or know much about it, but you know, you see shows like ER and you see the med students, you know, like just catching like 30 minutes of sleep. I mean, that's how I think about a time like this and the life of somebody who chooses to cook in restaurants that operate at this level. Like, that to me seems like it's just such an intense period of life, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I mean, I was married at one point. I'm not now. Mm-hmm. Like, that 100% has everything to do with it.
Yeah. You mean the career killed it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. How can it not?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that I'm a selfish person, but if I am devoting like 80 hours a week to my own career,
you're mathematically,
doesn't matter what your outlook,
you're mathematically
at, you are
screwed as the
asshole.
As your partner. Like, yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. I understand. Okay. So what comes after that? What comes after Stone Barns?
Dan Barber introduced me to Floyd and Danny Meyer.
Yeah.
They were opening up North End Grill. I just wanted to see a Danny Meyer project, whether that was like doing a few months at Gramercy Tavern.
Yep.
Like, I just, you know, I didn't want to commit to working at a Danny Meyer restaurant because I was hopefully looking to open up my own restaurant at that point. But Floyd agreed, you know, we worked something out where I came on a couple months before it opened. He let me sort of see some of the back end stuff.
Yeah.
And then I helped him get to the review. And then I left and I moved from North End Grill to Atera, where Matt Leitner was there. Matt was one of the only, Matt and a couple, there's two or three of us that were Americans working at Mugaritz at the time.
You guys were there together.
Yeah. So Matt Leitner, this friend of mine, Patrick Miller, who's the chef of a neighborhood restaurant around here called Rucola. We were the only Americans.
Got it.
And so Matt was opening up a Terra. So I just spent a couple months there helping him.
Yeah.
And then I went to Norway.
And at what point in all of this, like, you opened Olmsted last year.
Yeah.
At what point in these jobs that you just kind of took us through, when do you start? I mean, I assume like most young cooks, you had a notebook or some, you were kind of making, keeping track of, you know, recipes you liked and ideas for your own stuff and all that. When do you start conceiving in your mind, if it even happened at this point, of what ultimately became Olmsted? Like, when does that idea start to germinate? In other words, when do you stop just thinking about dishes and thinking about what kind of restaurant you'd like to have?
Right. I mean, for me, like I would, like, this is, I'm not trying to speak for anyone else, but I was not capable of coming up with a dish that I thought would work in my restaurant while I was working for Dan Barber or Thomas Keller, like, or Chef Hackett's. It was, this would work in this restaurant.
Uh-huh.
That is, like, there was no point of me thinking of a dish or I didn't even have the ability to think of a dish that would work in a different context.
Yeah.
You fully immerse yourself in the job that you have.
That's unusual. That's unusual, don't you think?
I don't know.
You haven't discussed it. This seems to me to be very unusual, having interviewed a lot of, it seems to me like so many people are like so chomping at the bit to have their own thing.
That's not what I'm getting paid to do, though.
No, I get it. I'm not putting it down.
Dan is telling me
yes
to run his restaurant, not to run what I think his restaurant should be like.
Do you consider yourself a very focused person in general? Like, on whatever's in front of you? Are you able to really sort
of...
Do you have that, like, laser focus?
I have that when I'm within the restaurant's walls.
Yes.
Outside of that, less so. You know, I'm like constantly, I'm always worried I'm going to get hit by a car because I'm just so aloof when I'm not in the restaurant.
Is that right?
But I have like Spider-Man like reflexes when I'm in the restaurant, but I'm always about to get hit by a bike messenger outside the restaurant.
I guess what I mean is, was it a deliberate discipline on your part to keep that kind of focus, or were you just kind of like, this is the job and this is why I'm here, and it wasn't even like you had to fend off an impulse to be spending
mental, or don't do it at all. It's the way my dad did it.
It goes back to all that, like, and the Boy Scouts and the...
Dan's not asking you to do something else.
Right. Yeah.
So don't do something else.
Right.
You know.
So that was your life at that moment, and that was that.
Yeah. I mean, that was from, you know, from like, it comes from my dad, I guess. I mean, my dad, it's like a little bit of a tangent, but like my dad was the type of guy where, you know, one time he was hanging up Christmas lights and I came downstairs.
Yeah.
And my brother was watching cartoons. So I was watching cartoons with him.
Yeah.
And then I drive him to the, we're driving to the, to our music lessons. I used to play guitar. My brother played the drums. I had to pay for my own lessons because I had a job.
Yes.
So since I had a job, I should pay for my own lessons. Right. But I also had to have a job. But my brother was too young to have a job, so his lessons were paid for.
Okay.
So on the way to this guitar lesson that I was driving him in my car broke down. And so I call my dad, who just fixes everything. Hey, you know, my car broke down. Can you help me? And his response is just, you didn't help me hang up the Christmas lights. Why would I come help you?
Wow.
Hangs up the phone, you know? So like, just always be like, if garbage needs to be taken out, you take it out. Like to this day, garbage day is on a Tuesday. I go home. If I haven't been home in 2 years and I know it's a Tuesday, like he will give me a look. Why am I not taking out the garbage? You know, the garbage is supposed to go out.
And it's so funny. Cause I mean, I know you and your dad are close just from knowing you. But you know, as a father, I got 2 13-year-olds and like, I have such admiration for that. Cause that's the harder way to be a parent. You know, like I realize that that is, it's much easier not, you know, sure, I'll come get you.
Yeah.
Your life will be a lot simpler. Anyway, let's take a break and then we'll come back. Let's talk about Olmsted.
Sure.
And for those of you listening, as always, if you'd like to subscribe to this show, you can do that on Stitcher and on iTunes. And as always, this is my weekly plea. If you are on iTunes, we would love a review. And it's not, I say this every week, it's not vanity. It helps people find the show. So if you have a minute, please do that. And we're speaking with Chef Greg Backstrom of Olmsted Restaurant in Brooklyn, New York. And we will be right back after this message. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Bob Moore is the founder of Bob's Red Mill, top quality supplier of grains, flours, and general nutritional goodness from Oregon. He's talking to us about their signature millstones, a very specific way of making whole grain flour. So what's the secret, Bob?
Follow me to the mill room. Well, these are just like the millstones that the Romans used to grind their grains. In fact, these stones came from the same quarry near Paris, France, where the Romans got their stones. The company that makes our millstones pulls their quartz from the same quarry, and they make mills for us that are just wonderful.
Bob explains how the millstones grind much slower and at cooler temperatures than modern steel rollers. The process keeps the grains cool, preserving the flavor and nutrition.
Look at what they produce. I love how they keep things simple and just right. All the nutrition is there, just like nature intended.
After almost 40 years in the milling business, they're serving up over 400 organic, gluten-free, and whole grain foods right here from the mill in Oregon, sending them off to destinations around the world.
We think we can make a difference by sticking to the traditional way of stone milling. And so, that's what we're doing.
To learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their mission to bring good food for all, visit bobsredmill.com/podcast.
And we're back talking with Chef Greg Backstrom at of Olmsted Restaurant in Brooklyn, New York. So, Greg, let's shift gears and let's talk about Olmsted.
Okay.
And well, why don't you tell me when do you start conceiving of the restaurant that ultimately became Olmsted, and what was that process like?
I mean, after I left Stone Barns, between Stone Barns and now, was about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, within that whole time, I was trying to, you know, open up a restaurant.
Right.
And I would meet with investors. Like at some point, you learn, okay, I know how to cook.
Yep.
You know, I can manage a team. I know how to cook. I don't know everything, but I can get that part down.
Yes.
And you're just, you know, even though you're working in these restaurants, you're not having conversations with wealthy people that are constantly saying, let's invest, you know, let us invest.
Right.
So you have to pivot and you have to start being more available to do tastings, to network. Like you have to devote more time into networking.
And how amorphous or unformed can the restaurant be when you start having those conversations? In other words, there's a person who's at that point in life that you were, that point in your career where you're like, okay, I'm ready.
Yeah.
And you start meeting with people who could maybe back that.
Yeah.
Is it sort of an abstract conversation? Is it, do you start that process with a business plan for a restaurant that had a name attached to it and
it's
very
all
clear?
No, it's all much more.
It's much more unformed.
Foolish. Yeah. It's like because you're going to someone who you think might give you money and you are not able to give any real information other than
that's what it was like.
Other than you're ready. I'm ready. You know.
Right.
I don't know what to do now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so you blow it with anybody that might have any confidence in giving you money. You're just showing them that you're not ready.
That's how you would describe your first interactions.
Most of them,
people were asking you questions to which you had no answers.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you leave those meetings like smacking yourself in the forehead and like feeling...
No, they were more polite. Like I didn't really realize that that's why I didn't get $4 million from that conversation.
Got it.
You know?
So with the later on, with the benefit of doing it right, you realize
after five of those conversations, it's like, okay, you need a lawyer. Even though you can't afford a lawyer, you need to figure out how to have a lawyer. And because there are just too many things. You don't have anyone on your side. There are just clearly now things after five of these conversations, you just don't know certain things.
Yes.
So you need somebody to give you help.
Uh-huh.
And so that person, in my case, was, I need a lawyer. Like I had the barbers I would reach out to. Nick Akonis and Grant Atkins, I would reach out to.
Yes.
And they would give advice and you know, guide me in the right direction.
Yes.
But at some point, like, you need to be paying for legal advice.
Yes.
And so that was the next move. And then I did that. And then, you know, not knowing what to ask for. What am I worth? You know, if someone's putting in $4 million into an idea, how much of that, you know, business do I end up owning? How much am I adding? If someone's putting $4 million, what am I adding to that business? And
so you brought on what we call a hospitality lawyer who could sort of be like your consigliere through all this.
Yeah.
That's reasonable. That's not reasonable.
Like you are worth this amount of
money.
Yeah. Like if someone is going to put $1 million into a restaurant, you're not asking for 50% of that restaurant.
Yeah.
If you're starting out, you know, 30 years old and have nothing else to offer other than like your resume is great.
Yep. So can you give a sense over that period of time, like how many meetings did you take? How many spaces did you look at?
20, 25.
Spaces.
Yeah.
In New York City, in Manhattan and Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Meetings about?
Yeah. Just from having a space and having the money and that falling through. And, you know, it was always like there was the space, there's the money, and then there's the people to do it with.
Right.
And like you needed all three to line up and like I could get two of them to the table at a time.
Yeah. It's like a jackpot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, you know, I would turn people off if I was too aggressive. Like I am worth like this and, you know, I need to make this amount of money a year and stuff. And, again, like that would come, like I would learn from that. Okay. That was too aggressive.
Yeah.
But I'm still worth that, but I approached that the wrong way or whatever, you know?
Right.
Or, you know, I want to be able to say, I want to pay my staff well.
Yes.
To the guy that's putting in all the money just sounds like I'm being wasteful with their money.
Right.
If I don't have a plan as to how am I going to pay my
staff
well.
Right, you're being gregarious with their, right.
Like I'm just being romantic.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
So I had to come up with the plan of how I wanted to pay the staff well. The next time I showed up to a meeting, I had that prepared.
This sounds like a very incremental, humbling, emotionally roller coastery period of time.
I mean,
because you're somebody who, you said it yourself, like, you know, you grow up kind of very goal oriented, you know, from the Boy Scouts to kitchens to your dad's sort of like this seems to me like you're like Johnny, you're used to being Johnny on the spot. And this was
I mean,
this seems like a time that it was probably very humbling for you.
I mean, it was, because it started out with trying to find $4 million to open up my own 3 Michelin Mecca restaurant to scraping together $200,000.
Yeah.
And opening up my neighborhood approachable, nothing is more than $24 restaurant.
Right.
You know?
So yeah, but
being told later when investors would ask me, you know, what do you want your restaurant to be like? How do you want your guests to feel? And my response was, challenged or intrigued I want them to get me or whatever.
Right.
Like, nobody wants that, you know,
you mean investors?
Investors don't want that.
They find that scary.
Well, I mean, I don't want that as a diner myself. And right. I was saying that I've been in New York for 8 years. I've been to one of the 4-star New York restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have an interest. So why am I going to now say everyone else should start paying me money to see my craft or my artwork?
Right.
It's just an obnoxious thought, you know? For me now in this point in my career, I don't feel like I am worth that. So how am I supposed to start demanding?
Right.
It was humbling.
Yeah. So as you're going through that process on the financial and business side of things, the restaurant, it sounds like, was morphing along with that realization.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that.
Into something where you could take the skills you'd amassed, the ideas that you had, the standards that you learned in these these places that are basically the top of the food chain, and adapt them to this different.
Yeah, not much changed. Place. I mean, there was I didn't have a name of a restaurant. Like, that came weeks before we opened.
Right.
You know, like, it was.
Well, that obviously is based in part on, Olmsted was
Olmsted
the
is Frederick design, Olmsted.
Right, who designed Prospect Park, and you're near the park.
Yeah, and he also designed the grounds for the Chicago World's Fair, which is, I'm from Chicago, so it just sort of clicked when the name came up. Even though we didn't spend $4 million, it's not that different of a restaurant than what I was originally set out to do.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I needed an outside space because I wanted to be able to grow something.
Yes.
And I wanted a small dining room, but not so small that it couldn't be profitable. And I like to eat at the bar, so I wanted a 10-seat bar.
Yes.
Like, once I got it down to those three things, 10-seat bar, small dining room, but not too small that I can't turn a profit, and something outside, like, 2 months went by and I came across the space.
Right.
And the right investors.
Uh-huh.
And
when you look back, does it seem like this was the place that you, I mean, not to be corny about it, but does it seem like this was good that you went through that? Like, does it seem like 100%. The place you were meant to open at this point in your life?
I mean, everybody warned me not to. Like, I took, everyone's advice from Paul Kahan to Grant Achatz to all these guys work hard, you know, achieve your goal, set up. But, they would warn me of, like, this $4 million restaurant, opening up your 3 Michelin star restaurant.
Yeah.
Be careful.
Right. Well, it's also funny. It's interesting to me because it's not a perfect analogy, but, you know, I come from a filmmaking background. You hear these stories about, people who have, you have a screenplay, right?
Yeah.
And you can shoot that screenplay for $10 million. Or you can sometimes shoot that screenplay for $1 million. And when you do the $1 million version, okay, maybe you can't have the top box office star. Maybe you can't have, the billion-dollar soundstage, you know. But you still have the great story.
Right.
You can often have incredible creativity that comes with financial limitation. Mm. And there have been a lot of amazing movies that were made. You know, you hear these stories like, Halloween, which is one of the great horror films of all time. It was shot in like 12 days or something for like no money.
Right.
You know? And it does sort of remind me of and when I hear, like, your story to me reminds me of that. Like there's this incredible jolt of energy and creativity, because you still have the same, you're still coming to it with the same mental tools that you would have, that you're going to bring to any project.
Yeah. I mean, it would, like, I thought in the beginning, okay, like, we'll do this now and then we'll get to the fine dining restaurant.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe hold back some tricks, but it doesn't work like that. You can't, you have to throw everything into it.
Right.
Like you don't get brought up that way and then work for those types of people.
Right.
And then, okay, I'm very calculating.
Yes.
But not in the, like, if this is a good idea, I'm not going to sit on it for 3 years and then give it to a guest. I'm going to find out, like, this is my venue. This is what I get.
Yes.
You know, like, it is theater. It is a stage.
Yes.
Like, the playlist is the same playlist. We open at 5 o'clock. You know, we close at 10:30. This is the show.
Yeah.
You know, we just, the guests get to pick the courses. There's no tasting menu, and, you know, it's not as, not as choreographed.
Yes.
Because it's a little bit pick and choose.
Yes.
But it's still it's still coming from the same approach from all the other restaurants that I've worked at.
Yeah.
I don't know better. This is what I have to work with. These are the.
Well, and the effect is that you guys, I mean, you know, there's an awful lot. I was going to use the word crammed, which makes it sound cluttered or crowded, which it's not. But there's, for the amount of space that you have, right?
Yeah.
There's an awful lot going on. You have the living wall when you come in on the right side.
Yeah.
You know, you have this, the bar on the left, and in addition to being able to dine there, you know, an amazing bar program.
Yeah.
You go out back, and there's, I mean, you know, there's the quail, and there's the little, what's in the tub?
Crawfish
in the tub. Yeah. And there's, I don't know, how many different things are growing out there that are edible in your garden?
Over 100
things that are edible in the equivalent of a typically sized
greenhouse. There's a 10-foot greenhouse.
10-foot greenhouse in like a typically sized Brooklyn brownstone backyard.
Yeah.
And an open kitchen.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an awful lot of action.
Yeah.
In the amount, I mean, in some ways, it's kind of it's sort of a metaphor for New York City, right? I mean, it's, you know,
I mean, we're just
it's like what people do with their apartments.
Yeah. I mean, you should see the basement. Like, I, you know, it's not an exaggeration. Like I said, you know, we have speed racks zip tied to the ceiling.
Yeah.
Just because we are trying to do more than a space that space really should be trying to do.
Yeah.
Which makes it uncomfortable at times for us, for the staff.
Yeah.
You know, the line at Olmsted would be a station at Per Se. There's 3 people that work in there, and then I jump behind the line.
Right.
You know, that is crowded.
Yes.
You know, the basement is just a table and a dish machine and then some speed racks.
Yeah.
You know, there's not this glamorous basement where we're able to keep the production going. The cooks have to take turns prepping downstairs, coming upstairs, using the one stove that we have, glaze all their stuff. Okay, I'm done. The next guy comes up.
Yeah.
But it's all part of it. You know, we want to be able to expand on that over time and hopefully make a nicer kitchen as we grow. But yeah, it's very New York. It's Brooklyn. Like, it is, like, we had to embrace that part. If we wanted to charge this amount of cover, if we wanted to charge this little, we had to do this amount of covers.
Yes.
Which means we need to be able to cram that people in here.
Yes.
Which, fortunately, we're doing. We're still busy every day.
Yeah.
But it's all tandem. I was just giving this speech to a trail that was applying yesterday. You know, like, we could pay our cooks well because the cooks are not working with the best products. They're working with the best products, but they're not working with the best equipment. All the equipment is old.
Yes.
We're spending all the money on our produce, on our cooks, and not charging for it.
Yes.
But that is a reason why we're busy. And because we're busy, we're able to pay the cooks well.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's like a vicious / you know, amazing cycle for us, because the guests benefit, the cooks benefit by learning new skills and getting paid, compensated well, you know, but it's not glamorous.
Yeah. How do you enjoy, being the chef at this point? Like, do you, as someone who's still relatively young, do you ever miss, you know, just being on the line?
Yeah. 100%.
You do.
I mean, even now, we're just, I was just talking to the team the other day, like, we're like 18 months into this, and we're only just figuring out how I can be on the line more.
Actually on the line.
Yeah.
During service?
Yeah. It's been, like, we're so busy, it's so small, that up until now, it has been almost a disservice. It's been a distraction. It's if I jump behind the line to save something,
Does that happen sometimes?
Yeah, it happens, but it's it doesn't always help. It doesn't always help,
and it's not the way it's supposed to be.
Well, like if someone's doing something wrong, you know, someone needs to help correct it.
Yes,
but someone has to maintain
order.
The flow of service. Like, that's not the only thing going on in the restaurant.
Yeah.
So then usually Jenny is the one that the chef de cuisine jumps in there,
yes,
because the flow of service can't stop just because one guy is having a hard time cooking duck breast.
Yes.
But I should and want to be the person helping train the person doing the cooking that duck breast.
Yes.
But it's just too small, too busy, and too crowded that it really is. And there's too many other things going on.
Right.
That we've like only just occurred to us that, like, okay, Jenny, you stay here, and now I'll keep jumping in
for her to stay at the pass, and you actually work.
Yeah, cook. So like now for a little while now, like I've been able to actually just cook while everything is going because I trust Jenny to do the expediting, and you know.
Okay, now I've
so eaten, now it's been really great.
I've eaten at the you guys have the bar, and then you have the four seats that actually at the kitchen.
Yeah, right.
Right. So I've seen you expedite. I've seen Jenny expedite.
Yeah.
You guys don't do it identically.
No.
So different styles, which is fine.
Yeah.
But so you're in the kitchen.
Yeah.
When you're on the line, in other words, I'll use the film analogy again. You know, you might have someone who is a director who also acts, uh-huh, right?
Yeah.
Are you able to just be the actor in that scenario?
No. No, of course, I would control it all. You know,
okay.
I mean, I'm not micromanaging the pace of you know, how Jenny is expediting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, to the person I'm helping, it's helpful. And to the two other people that have to work around me now,
right?
I'm sure it's a nuisance.
Or an adjustment, at least.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because you're the boss.
Yeah,
yeah.
But it's...
But again,
if they're not there to learn, then
right, right.
You're going to be gone in a couple weeks anyway. So.
Are you... and you're enjoying being back?
I love it.
You're totally grinning as you're talking about it.
Yeah, because I love it. You know, it's... I'm getting used to grabbing the hot trays again.
Yes.
like it really...
The physicality, action.
I used to take pride in that when I would work service that I could throw my spoon into my bane without it making a sound from anywhere in my station.
Uh-huh.
That like I just knew where everything was at.
Yeah.
And I could hear how something was cooking.
Yes.
And I would... like hum techno music or house music in my head to keep a beat as to like how my movements were.
Yeah.
And you know, that when you're talking to guests and you're making sure that the menus were printed and all, you know, like,
and yet you're like literally 2 feet away from
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, and honestly, it took a couple of bad services for it to be like, okay, enough's enough. I have to be like, someone else has to expedite and I have to be over here now.
Uh huh.
Like, either I'm not training properly, and it's the recipes and the techniques are coming too secondhand, or something. But something was wrong. Something was the cooks were not being taught well enough.
Yeah. But also, it seems to me. I mean, it's funny when I asked you the question about if you missed it. That was not a setup. I didn't know the answer was that you're actually back on the line sometimes. That's unusual, isn't it? It seems unusual to me. I don't know many chefs who have...
Well, we'll see what happens when I have...
Who have, you know, leapt back. But it's... I mean, there's clear delight for you in doing it.
Because
that's what drew you to it in the first place.
Yeah, it's not... like, again, I love it all. You know, I love the challenge of it. I like when I was at Stone Barns, there was a period where I could recognize when guests were being brought into the kitchen
Yes.
that you know, Dan wasn't around or Dan was in the office or something.
Yeah.
And they just, they wanted somebody in the kitchen staff to shake their hand. They wanted to meet one of the chefs, you know? And me being shy, I just sort of would pretend like I couldn't see them. Eventually I saw that as a character flaw. And so then I would start to say hi to them.
Yeah.
And so that was within my field. That was a problem. That was a challenge.
Yes.
That was something I needed to be better at. So now I work at that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are more of those things now, now that I'm the owner of the restaurant.
Yeah.
So I still love that, but at the core of it is still cooking.
Yeah.
And I like to think that I'm good at it and I want to get better at it.
Yeah.
You know?
So last question for you, there seems to be a pretty steady flow of new dishes at the restaurant. I see it when I come in. And also I see it on your Instagram.
Yeah.
You know, I think maybe I'm wrong. I feel like twice maybe in the last 2 weeks I've seen...
Most of the menu is changing this
week. So-and-so is going on tonight.
Yeah.
There was just something yesterday.
Yeah.
Do you have in your head... Is there... How fluid a process is that? In other words, do you have... almost like airplanes lined up for a runway.
No,
like, do you have a bunch of ideas waiting?
Nothing.
Are they being put on as they occur to you? Do you kind of have in your head, okay, it's fall, it's time to turn over the menu, I need X amount of new dishes, and then you go about coming up with them? What drives the change, in other words?
It sounds cliche and obnoxious, but it's the truth. It's ingredient-driven.
Uh-huh.
And so...
I don't think that's...
It is. It's because it just is, farm-to-table ingredient-driven.
Right.
It's just like the most...
Fine.
Whatever, generic. It doesn't mean anything, which is how I describe the restaurant.
Yeah.
But it is. It is actually that way. It is not... I don't see something in someone else's cookbook and then I want to make my own koji now because someone else is doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Olmsted has been open for 9 months. We haven't worked with crab. Let's work with crab now.
Yeah.
Okay, so crab, blah, 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 blah. Okay, we have kale growing on our garden. We need to get that. We're planning a menu. We haven't worked with crab. Yeah, we still haven't figured out where we're putting crab in the menu. Okay, well, this is coming off the menu, so we need something that's fried. Okay, crab rangoon. Someone spits out crab rangoon.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we make ricotta. Our ricotta is really good, so let's not buy... store-bought cream cheese. So let's try it. Let's get some really nice piquito crab meat in. Let's take the kale out of the garden. And let's take our ricotta and see what happens.
Yeah.
That's the crab rangoon.
Yeah.
Like, it is ingredient-driven. It is in no reason... I like crab rangoon. I had never had crab rangoon before we put it on the menu.
And it didn't start with you thinking, I want to do crab rangoon.
Not at all. It was crab.
Yeah.
We have kale growing in the garden, and there's crab. Lamb. We want to participate in whole animal butchery. We can't do large animals. There's too much going on in our small restaurant that even a pig is too big for us. Like we cannot change the menu so often to where it's okay. Today it's loin and tomorrow it's roasted shoulder.
Yes.
It has to be somewhat the same. Then the whole thing goes away and something else comes in.
Yep.
Like I can't charge $23 because it's the loin today. And then I charge $21 because it's, pulled meat.
Yep.
So these lambs are small enough. We just debone the whole thing.
Yep.
We braise the whole thing. We tie it. And so now, whether it's the loin, the shoulder, leg, it's all just mixed together now.
Yes.
And we just made sort of a porchetta out of the whole lamb.
Yeah.
But now everybody's going to get the same exact thing, but they're getting a whole animal.
Yeah.
So they're not getting a loin or a rack or anything. They're going to get this braised piece of meat.
Yes.
But it's because we want to use whole lamb.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've been told that they eat apples, so apples and curry go together, so we made a cure out of curry, and so now we'll try to incorporate some type of apple or pear or something like that to go with the dish.
Yes.
Or maybe not, but the pear, the apple and curry made sense, so that led it to the curry. Okay, let's go in Indian direction. So that doesn't mean that now obnoxiously we're going to serve it 8 apples, now you have to eat it with an apple.
Right.
But again, it was ingredient driven. It was, I miss duck. I want to start cooking duck again.
Yeah.
Okay, radicchio is at the market right now. Sunchokes are great right now. What else? There's pears. Maybe we do red wine poached pears. and duck classic. Yep. Let's go classic with this one. Let's not get too weird with this one. Let's just go great.
Is that a balance you try to maintain?
Oh yeah, all the time.
All the time.
Okay, crab rangoon's on the menu. The next thing that they should eat should be a little less weird.
Right.
Less playful, maybe a little bit more serious is the next
thing. I think of those as anchors.
Yeah.
Something familiar, something that it's just something you've been eating your whole life that feels, I mean, for lack of a better word, normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In no way is any of it supposed to be challenging.
Yeah.
You know, we don't put words that people don't recognize unless it's like intentionally to make someone laugh or to strategically have them ask a question.
Uh-huh.
Which is just another way for them to open up more dialogue between their service.
Question for you. And I guess we can say who it is. We're not going to ask for any great stories, but you were a private chef during that period of time when you were trying to make a restaurant happen. You worked for the Seinfelds.
Yeah.
A lot of people have spoken to me about private chefing. I mean, it's interesting. A lot of people now are leaving kitchens to go do that.
I know.
But for a long time, that was something that people did traditionally when you did it, like sort of fill a gap while you're trying to get your own restaurant together or between jobs. But a lot of people have said to me over the years that they found private chefing to be a great transitional thing to do as you're getting ready to become a chef because you are sort of cooking your own, it's an opportunity to experiment. I mean, it depends on the client, obviously.
Yeah, right.
But did you find it to be that way?
No.
No.
I mean, it's not about me. It's like someone is paying me for me to make the food that they want.
Right.
Not like, here's my carrot crepe dish.
So even
that
job for you was
chicken parm.
That was more similar to working in another restaurant than it was to working in your own restaurant.
They like Italian food. I'm making Italian food most of the time.
Yeah.
Of course, like there were times they would have parties and they would say, let loose, Greg, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And then I would do it.
Yeah.
But it's not about me. Like someone else is giving me money so I do something for them.
Yes.
It's not the other way around.
Yeah. It's so funny you put it that way. Cause I have heard among chefs, people will sometimes refer to another chef and say that person cooks for themselves. And it's a put down.
Oh, it is. It's annoying.
Yeah.
I don't eat at those restaurants.
Yeah. When you come up with an idea for a new dish, what's your success rate? In other words, how do you usually tend to kind of stick the landing the first time out, or is there usually a lot of trial and error?
I mean, we don't, again, because it's so small, and now we have a little bit more people in the kitchen.
Yeah.
There's still only seven of us, kind of me. But before, when it was me and one or two other cooks,
yes,
peas were in season. Okay, the challenge was we want peas to be an entree. How do you make a small English pea an entree? That became falafel.
Uh-huh.
So that falafel dish probably changed every night for 2 weeks. There was everything from a foam on it in the beginning, which was obviously not a great choice. But now it's one of our most popular dishes.
Right.
And, we got it to the point where, like, everything on it was delicious.
Yeah.
Was it a smart dish?
Yeah.
Was it clever? Was it anything? None of those things were true. It was not.
Right.
It was just, well-seasoned pea falafel with some purees and stuff.
Yeah.
The carrot crepe dish was one and done. Like, it was, again, ingredient-driven. We were opened in May. People think May, it's the weather is changing. It's spring. They're expecting other things. It was my first restaurant. There's asparagus was not even in season yet. How am I going to show off when I got nothing to work with?
Yes.
So I wrote down every product I could get from the farmer's market to purveyors, to fishermen. And after I matched everything up, it was carrots and clams. And so I was like, okay, what the hell am I going to do with carrots and clams? So I applied some Alinea and Perse techniques to it. And that became the dish. And that one worked. The frozen yogurt, that we do was just like...
Awesome.
Of our desserts are baby food. Like, there's no texture. Like, I hate chefy desserts.
Yeah.
I think it's annoying.
Yeah.
I don't want pumpernickel or olive in my dessert.
Yeah.
I want chocolate, vanilla, fruit.
I'm the same way.
Like, I just, like, it's not, no slight to any pastry chef. I just don't want it. Like, at that point, even whether it's a 6-hour meal or I had a pasta and and a dessert.
Yeah.
I don't want...
You want something elemental.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's, for us, it's the chocolate mousse.
Yes.
Which only is chocolate. There's the frozen yogurt. Yes. It's our vanilla ice cream, but it's not boring. We, you know, we tried to make it not, like a little more exciting. So it's, that's the frozen yogurt with the whipped honey.
Yeah.
And then the fruit thing changes whenever, you know, right now it's Jell-O. So right now, none of our desserts have texture.
Yeah.
It's Jell-O with whipped cream. It's Concord grape. It's amazing grape juice.
Yeah.
Yogurt.
Yeah.
And chocolate.
Sweet and creamy.
But like, if you want fruit, if you want chocolate, if you want ice cream.
You come to the right place.
Yeah.
Great. All right. Greg, thanks for letting me come to your apartment.
Of course. Yeah.
And thanks for being on the show.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Great. Thanks. And that's our show. A huge thank you to Greg Backstrom for making time to do the interview this week. And as always, a big thank you to David Tadashor, our engineer. David, thank you for splicing this thing together. As you always do, we really appreciate it. And as always, if you'd like to follow the show on Twitter and or Instagram, it is at Chef Podcast. That's at Chef Podcast. And you can follow me personally in the same places, Twitter and Instagram, at Toqueland Andrew, T-O-Q-U-E, L-A-N-D, Andrew. That's our show. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.